It lives alone and mostly hidden in its own magic kingdom. Its members are said to include the largest living organism on Earth. That so many down-to-earth-type people become its ardent devotees leads us to ask, what is the magic of mushrooms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,392nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, there is a mushroom festival in the works in the woods above our small coastal community of Santa Cruz. I suspect a lot of people will be attending from the nearby San Francisco Metroplex to enjoy a taste of the magic that is mushrooms. When the organizer of this festival told me about the largest known living organism on Earth is a mushroom, or more appropriately, a fungus, I knew there was a lot to this living organism that was simply not very well known. And I wondered, why do we know so little about the magic kingdom of mushrooms? Well, fortunately, the organizer of the Santa Cruz Mountain Mushroom Festival has graciously consented to give us a peek into that magic kingdom, and he is Ian Garoni of Far West Fungi in Moss Landing, California. Ian, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really delighted to be here today.
Great. Let's start with that biggest living organism on Earth and use it to kind of paint a broad brush picture of what this magic kingdom of mushrooms is. As we know them, we call them mushrooms, but a lot more than mushrooms. So tell us about the largest organism on Earth, living organism.
Well, as some people know, that fungi itself has the ability to, really is there to mainly break down, or one of their functions to break down woods or leaf matter in the wild. It's kind of a basic function. And as it is kind of breaking it down, it's also, pulling in a lot of the nutrients and growing out, and then, eventually has to fruit in some way so that it hopefully can, continue on with generations of fruiting or mushrooms that will generally pop up. So when we're talking about some of these really large, intricate structures, they are usually these mycelium mats, which is basically the living organism that's running through and making these very small connections with trees and grass and just everything that's underfoot.
Kind of like the internet, isn't it?
It very, very similar to the internet, or, very advanced road systems. They're trying to find the most efficient and effective way to be able to cross over distance and on the way pick up as much nutrients or potentially what some would consider to be intelligence about what is going on around them so that they can continue to grow the best that they can. And so what you generally see is, if you have been in your backyard and you take a shovel and dig underground and you see this white network that almost looks like a spider web, that is the actual mycelium running through the ground. And as we see it on, say, like in our farm, in our lab, we start off in a petri dish and we watch this circular white ring run out from the center to the outer side of the petri ring. And what you see in the ground is a very similar process of a round ring. So when we see mushrooms that are kind of in this fairy ring shape, or they seem like they're kind of in a big long circle, and you can see that in some grasses. But a lot of times when you're just walking in the forest, you'll notice that things kind of look, have like a crescent look to it. That's the outer band of the mycelium working through the soil, and then growing mushrooms on the outer ring. And that will continue to grow larger and larger, if, as long as it doesn't get disrupted.
Armillaria ostoyer. Is that how you pronounce it?
I call it honey mushrooms. It's also an edible variety, probably consumed a little bit more in Europe, but they are amazing in the clusters that they grow. And usually we see fruitings of them at the base of, usually dying trees at the beginning of the winter for us on the West Coast. And with a significant amount of rain, they tend to pop up in these what seem to be small, cute little brownish, golden capped colored tops to them. And then they can grow to be bunches that are, about the size of a large, bouquet of flowers, and a foot tall or so. So they're a very elongated stem and a very short cap. And then they have a spore that's kind of white, and you can usually identify them by, once they drop their spore or their seed onto, say, the tops of the other mushrooms that are growing in that cluster, it's usually a good indicator that what mushroom they are. And so they can be identified that way.
Good. And when we see them, what we're seeing is just the indicator that there is a big colony of life going on beneath that. And that the mushroom itself is just like a freckle on the organism, right?
Yeah, it really is. That particular variety of mushroom is fairly destructive. It is really, once you see it kind of attached to the root system of a tree, it usually is a sign that tree is not really doing well, and it probably has a couple more years before it actually falls or breaks. So you have to like pay attention to that too. If it's right next to your house, that's a great indicator of, hey, something, is going to have to be done to this tree before it actually maybe lands on my house. Just one of those things that the more that you're in touch with nature, it could be very helpful. Might save your car or your house one day. And they're also they're just so unique in how massive those mycelium bases tend to be. And that's when we're talking about some of the largest organisms in the world aren't necessarily like what we consider more like animals, like whales, like that, but like are probably a bunch of different fungi that are growing throughout the world.
And we understand that there is one family, I don't know what you'd call it, cluster of fungi up in Oregon, 2,385 acres, 2,400 years old. Amazing.
Absolutely. It's some of the larger bracket mushrooms that you see on the side of trees too. You know, those can be ancient as well. So, even the fruiting bodies themselves, the part that is dropping spore can have, 10, 20, 30 years on them. So it is quite amazing just to witness that, to see it. And I know Paul Stamets has had a variety of mushrooms that he's been kind of, really focusing in on, that is the officialis or a agaricon mushroom that comes out of the Pacific Northwest. And there are some large growths that are actually associated with some petroglyphs and some other indigenous peoples, kind of like shamanistic or medicinal,
right,
kind of areas. And so, these these fruiting bodies were probably there for a long period of those times, or where they knew they were, where they grew. So it is interesting how a fungi from a very early, early on relationship with humans is kind of like got us moving, got us going in different directions and appreciation.
Easy to see how we become so fascinated with them. Now, are they plant or are they animal or are they human or what are they?
We like to think they're somewhere in between a plant and an animal. You know, their origins are, or their structure definitely seems to be more of a plant, plant-like.
Because they live in the soil, right?
Well, they live in soil, but they're not necessarily dependent on the sun light. So, you know, they are definitely getting their nutrients from the soil. But they also take on oxygen, and that is very animal-like in a way. So, it's a wonderful kingdom all its own, which I think have just really been bypassed over the years to a certain degree, you know, for as far as like the consumption of food. You know, mushrooms are unique. They are different. They're not necessarily what is considered mainstream. So kind of overlooked for their potentials as like protein, or potassium, or just, you know, the use of them in place of meat. And they have texture and flavor profiles that are very similar. So, you know, as we are finding that some of our, you know, proteins, are maybe not as sustainable as we'd like them to be. I think a lot of people are turning to mushrooms as the alternative source, and
over the course of people relating with mushrooms, which is goes back forever, we've come to see them as food, medicine, and as a environmental restorative. We're going to have to take a quick break when we come back. My goodness, you've been selling fungus at the farmers markets for 50 years. So you're kind of, in doing so, you must have become kind of like an evangelist family of mushrooms, because you have to look at all these people that walk up to you in the farmers market and say, "What is this? Will it poison me?" Because that's what everybody's afraid of. And I'm sure that you have perfected some answers through 50 years of selling at farmers markets. So those are things we'd like to pick up when we come back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Ian Garoni, Far West Fungi in Moss Landing, California. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, back to What's Eating What. Well, one of the things that's eating what is the, I guess, the mycelium that runs underneath our feet throughout the soil, going from place to place looking for food. And what it eats is, gee whiz, just about everything. Is that true, Ian Garoni? Is it true that fungus eats about everything?
It eats about just about everything. There's, you know, different varieties that like certain things over others. And one of the really fun parts about cultivating or growing mushrooms or trying to figure out what do we have a lot of waste, agricultural waste of in the state of California, and what mushrooms might be able to eat those.
And thus you're recycling the waste products into something usable.
Absolutely. That's one of the, you know, kind of, I would say it's one of the more exciting parts of our farm is to be part of the chain that is taking these, you know, more complex fibers, breaking them down. And then once our mushrooms have their way with them, being able to send the spent, what we call spent substrate or spent material off to other organic farms to be able to put in their orchards and help their soil. So we find that we can be useful on both sides of the spectrum of soil and soil health.
Well, let's look at the mushroom as a food source. What is its nutrient profile? And I assume that changes from one variety of mushrooms to the next, correct?
Absolutely. You know, we at Far West Fungi are a little bit more advanced, I would say, on what we try to cultivate than other farms, where, you know, most farms, if you're sticking with four varieties of mushrooms, you really are kind of maybe, you know, exceeding how much you can possibly do. We grow 12 varieties. A few of them are more seasonal for the summertime, that like, you know, more humid, warmer conditions. So when we're talking about our mushroom varieties, it is a little bit complex on, you know, what's what as far as the nutrients. But there are some generals. The fact that they are growing on woods, the general function or what they're doing is they're very absorbent. So they will pull these polysaccharides or complex sugars out of the wood.
Ian, let's back up just a little bit and differentiate Far West from some of the commercial commodity mushroom growers. We have here in this neck of the woods one of the largest mushroom growers in the world, as I understand. I don't know if it still is, but it's a huge one. And it grows mushrooms on mushroom compost, and it grows a few varieties, and it ships them in large quantities to probably wholesalers and large retailers around the country. That's not what you do at all.
Correct. Correct. We are usually in the state of California, we're looking at, agaricus mushrooms, your standard white, brown, and portobello mushrooms, which are agaricus bisporal varieties, a very common place that you see in the grocery store. They grow on generally on the ground on compost, and then there is a peat moss layer that is put on top, and then basically the process of, I believe it's 3 or 4 months to harvest them, usually is done on these like 4x6 trays around here. We grow everything on a sawdust base to it, and we grow them in these 5-pound bags that are filtered to allow the mushrooms and the mycelium to breathe a little bit. So we basically put a recipe together of sawdust and rice bran, and, you know, it could be almond hull, it could be cocoa core, it could be anything that might be available out from other farmers.
Real fibrous stuff.
It can be. You know, oyster mushrooms we grow on pulverized straw. Sometimes these commodities go up and down in the state of California. So, you know, one moment we might have a recipe for that and we might change it or say, okay, well, there's a lot of almond hull out in the world. Like what can we grow that is going to really be able to break that down and create these relationships? So we have a little bit more diversity in what we can use. It's not based off of a composted straw and peat moss. We have a little bit more free rein to what we can grow. And so we grow shiitakes and oyster mushrooms and king trumpet and lion's mane, all which you would normally find if it were out in the wild growing on logs. And so the nutrients that you're getting off of it, mainly you're talking about vitamin B6 and 12, a lot of, you know, niacin, potassium, a good amount of protein is found in them, and they do kind of vary quite a bit. I think one of the, as we are learning more about fungi and specifically what we're producing, we're finding that a lot of them fall under what is considered to be adaptogens, like their ability to, for your body to absorb them and then use their immune boosting properties to kind of help you with just a gambit of, you know, potential issues that you might be having. So as you're taking in this nutrients from the mushroom, it's not really like, hey, I'm going to help you with, you know, whether it's inflammation or possible, you know.
So it's not a targeted medication. What it does is that it enhances your body's ability to fight.
Exactly. So it's I think it's very useful. So, you know, not something that I always, as a family or as a business, that we really pushed. It was something that we really learned a lot from our customers doing farmers markets. At a very young age, my father, would, you know, I work with at farmers markets with my father, and he would say, hey, you know, we're not doctors. We really are growing these mushrooms, and, you know, as much as you hear about how nutritious they are, we're really, you know, what we're trying to talk to our customers about is texture and flavor and how to cook. And it wasn't until probably in my teens when I would have customers that would come to me and say, hey, I need lion's mane mushrooms because my doctor at UCSF said, you know, I got in a car accident and I have these lacerations, and said I should take this because it could really help with nerve endings and regenerating nerve endings. So I'm going to start taking this. And then having dialogue for months or years with our customers about how well it was going for them, and not having to be really on a whole lot of pharmaceutical drugs. And that's when I kind of like, those were the aha moments where mm-hmm. it was like, you know, what we are growing is so powerful. And now, you know, we do have some tincture line of our mushrooms and, you know, develop them into dried mushrooms. We also have a gummy line that we're working on because we are using it a little bit more as medicine now, and we like the balance of, you know, food is medicine, so gravitate towards eating foods that are better for you and you know, take them in as, you know, a good supply of them on a regular basis, and our job is really to make that affordable and as easy for our customers to kind of understand and
well it, consume. In a business sense, you're practicing exactly what I preach in my book, Metro Farm, wherein when you go up against the Goliaths of an industry, of a business, almost any business, it doesn't matter. When you go up against a Goliath, you can't do what they're doing. And so you're not growing commodity mushrooms in a commercial way. And so you're competing with them by growing something that they can't grow, which is a specialty mushroom. specialty in many different respects. And what they have is a commodity. And whoever grows commodities in the commodity business, whoever can grow the most for the least wins.
Right.
And in your business, that is not the case at all, because you're growing very special things in very special ways. And that's something that a industrial scale producer can't do.
And I think what's been amazing about having, you know, running the family business, my parents are still very much involved with it, but they do have some, you know, wonderful goals and some ideals that I think, you know, it's not always business for us. So one of the first things that we really wanted to work on early on is seeing how the commodities of agaricus were kind of a little bit stagnant and a little bit old school about business practices and holding on to a lot of information that sometimes is good, sometimes is proprietary, but overall maybe not as vetted. As a farm, we decided we were going to be open source. We were going to allow other farms, if they wanted to, kind of model after us or work with the different strains that we have. But we weren't going to purchase our cultures and our different strains. We were going to try to really work with other farms to collect them, store them for other people, and utilize, you know, what is a better growing strain here and there. And then also work on automation, because in the state of California, the cost for employees are really high, and you have to make it as easy and efficient as possible just to really be able to make it affordable for people to consume. So how do we do that? How do we get the price down, be as, you know, send it out as direct to our customers as possible, but also create a environment where, you know, other people are thriving than just our business. So we spend a lot of time to support other smaller farms because our goal is really to raise the domestic production instead of importing it in from parts of Asia or wherever it comes in, to try to create this U.S. Production with small farmers, bringing them to the farmer's market or their local grocery store, setting up, you know, a good business, probably not one that's going to just be a Goliath, but survive and then have their community. And we've been on that track for, I would say, about half our time, about 20 years now, of really focusing in on that. And it's starting to create a community of, you know, just different thinkers. And I think people who are into mushrooms are really more open. It's a different style. And maybe it's not all about dollars and cents at the end of the day, but it really does become more about community and getting the best quality out there. Because we know that when somebody experiences a quality mushroom in a grocery store, takes it home, cooks it, enjoys it, they're going to want more. And U.S. consumption is really, if you look at it on a global scale, is like microscopic compared to parts of Europe and Japan and China and Korea. And we feel like there's so much more to consume, and also, you know, health wise, just making that conversion over time is going to be really good for U.S. consumers.
You bring up two interesting points. One is that it's hard for city people to enjoy a commodity food. Hey, look, I just bought this tomato. It was grown on 10,000 acres with 10,000 acres of other tomatoes. Isn't it cool? No, not cool at all. It's no big deal. It doesn't even taste like a tomato. Go away and leave me alone. On the other hand, you have, oh, look at this. I found this organic heritage dry farm tomato that was picked ripe from the vine and brought straight to the farmer's market. Taste this. No, you can't taste this. This is my tomato. So Well, I guess what I'm saying is that city people like special things because we're removed from the food. We don't have much proximity to our food. And so commodity foods are commodity foods. They always come wrapped in plastic or something like that. And I think that what you're doing is really providing an impetus for us to come to know what mushrooms could really be by virtue of your work at farmers markets, because that is where you can do the proselytizing that you can't really do on television. You can't really look somebody in the eye and say, this shiitake mushroom is very special because, and have that person look you in the eye and see what you're saying is really true, that there is something very special here. And that's how you are changing the world to what I believe is a very good destination, real food from real farmers. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking with Ian Garoni, who of Far West Fungi in Moss Landing, California, where the weather is perfect for growing fungus. And when we come back, I'd like to get into the business of what Ian is doing and how he competes with the big boys like China. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Garoni family of Far West Fungi has been selling mushrooms at farmers market for 50 years. What fun that must be to meet all of these people who are coming through and looking at your mushrooms and asking which one's poisonous? I bet that. Ian, how many people ask you if you have any poison mushrooms?
Not as many people as the people who ask me if they're psychedelic or not. There's still quite a few people who are, you know, out there wanting to learn how to forage, and they'll even bring in baskets of mushrooms to have me identify. That can get a little tricky at times when you're trying to sell fresh mushrooms in your store, but it's still, as people want to engage with nature, trying to figure out how and where they're going to get that information is a little difficult to navigate. So we always recommend the local mycological societies and coming out our events so that people can learn a little bit more about.
Like Mushroom Festival. Yeah. So we'll be talking about that here toward the end of the show. But I'd like to turn back on the business of mushrooms and how you go about competing in the world is a lot different than a commodity grower that sells to the supermarkets around the country. So you have a narrow spectrum of very special mushrooms that you sell to the marketplace, correct?
Correct. Yes, and
some of them, shiitake. What are some of your varieties, the more popular ones?
Shiitake is our biggest production mushroom right now. So it is definitely number one. Our tree oyster variety is number two on the list. Very versatile, great texture to it. Lion's mane mushrooms, which has this interesting crab-like texture to it, and also known for its medicinal properties, are number three for us. Our maitake mushroom, or also called hen of the woods, great flavor texture profile, is going to be number four. And then we grow king trumpet. We grow a pink and a yellow oyster mushroom. We grow reishi. We grow turkey tail now, just strictly as medicinal mushrooms.
So pretty much those are all mushrooms you don't see in the supermarket.
Yeah, we are trying, really hard to kind of get it there. Oyster mushrooms and shiitakes are two that you can see in the grocery store now. Maitake is starting to be a little bit more present in the grocery stores. But it's still a specialty store focused on higher end produce that would be bringing them in.
Okay, good. Yeah. Competition, as I said, you have to compete in the world for the consumer dollars. And it's probably difficult, if not impossible, for you to compete in the commercial marketplace, because the industrial growers can grow tons and tons and tons of it at a very low price point. So you have to find a different way. And your way was to go to special mushrooms grown in special ways. And that's pretty much the strategy that all small farmers must employ in one way or another in order to be able to compete and survive and prosper. And then you develop this, and then along come the Chinese. And competing with them is a whole different ballgame. As I understand, one thing I've heard is that the Chinese have been sending over inoculated logs to grow mushrooms. They leave China, and they grow on the way over. The mushrooms grow, and so they're well on their way by the time they get here. But the mushrooms can be labeled grown in America when they're harvested here. So it's an interesting world that you face now.
It is as a supplier of the substrate to either other farms or the desire for other farms to be able to create these blocks. It becomes very desirable to, for other farms to say, hey, forget all this really hard work that goes into making these blocks. I'm going to buy these really cheap things and and grow mushrooms off of them and sell them as a local product. There are some problems. Mushrooms, as we were talking about with the nutrients, they're very absorbent on a lot of these complex materials and how they absorb it. So you know, including heavy metals. So if your source isn't the cleanest or your standards aren't really high, you have the potential for, you know, lead and cadmium to get in there and some other things. So we're you know, as being like a single source farm, growing everything from our farm, we have ideals about like what exactly is considered to be the raw, you know, good raw material. And sometimes we spend a little bit more on that. We spend more time on our food safety, and we spend a lot of times on sterilization and making sure that we're not, you know, we're certified organic. So no sprays in anything that we do. But when you're talking about the import, and it's really 99% of the world's production is, of mushrooms is produced in China and distributed throughout the world. It makes it really hard for anyone, country in general, to be able to kind of keep up with that when every mushroom is a commodity in China, and to the point of, you know, overproduction and then shipping out a product just to get it out. Because, you know, it's all the economy of scale and really kind of like just push. So when you have a lot of smaller families, a lot of smaller farms that are getting into the mushroom biz, it becomes very, very daunting. So something like the farmer's market is potentially the best way to, you know, get almost a retail price, not having to deal with middlemen, and being able to get, you know, at least what you need to be able to make it in this kind of environment. The environment is changing a little bit. The cost of shipping is going up. The, you know, this interesting tariff scenario that we're in right now really is throwing the mushroom industry on its head. And then we also are working, you know, internally to create standards that say, hey, you know, California should have a California grown certificate for mushroom growing, so that like a box, you can, if you're a California grower, you can put this on your box and people know this is coming from California. It's not being sourced from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And even the material that it's growing on is locally sourced to help out the local economy and everything as we, you know, are using these soils to help out other farms. It's very, you know, this food chain that we're all trying to be a part of. So, you know, I think right now we just need, consumers are wanting to know where their product and their food is coming from, and just need to be a little bit more aware of where exactly is it coming from. And
it's really, you know, it's really interesting with respect to the logs coming in from China, where you can throw them in the garage and they can grow mushrooms and they could be produced locally and you could sell them as local mushrooms, mm-hmm. but they're not. And you're actually cheating when you do that. Now, I have a sneaking suspicion that it's impossible for you to mislead your customers at farmers markets, because you have to look them in the eye. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings is you have to find food with its farmer's face on it to know what's in the food. And I just have a sneaking suspicion that it's almost impossible for you to lie about your food. Am I wrong?
It's very hard for me to, you know, as a local farmer, it comes to a certain point where, you know, I would be cheating my employees. I would be cheating and my, you know, my customers have been loyal customers for so long. And really it is trying to listen to what they're saying at the farmer's market and doing the best we can to make that product available for them the way they want it. And so, you know, there's a lot of not just customers now, but friends after, you know, 40 plus years of kind of doing this myself, that we're just trying to do right by them and doing right overall by saying, you know, this is a general population of people who are consuming, and especially from the farmers markets, these are really important, you know, concepts for them. And unfortunately, it's the way that it's set up right now, through, you know, whether it's the government or just certain standards that are up, there's these little loopholes that unfortunately allow for product to come in from China and be labeled as California or U.S. grown. And we are, as a small company, trying to work through this through assembly bills and, you know, working closer with, you know, federal
bureaucracy that always goes for the money. And that's the tough part for being a small family farmer, is that the industrial producers have the economies of scale to be able to hire somebody on K Street in Washington, D.C. to represent their industry. And you can't really do that very well because you simply don't have the economies of scale. Perhaps by putting together all of the mushroom farmers of California, you could come up with something and fight that way. But the best fight you have, I think, is person to person at the farmer's market, because people can look in your eye and see what's in the food. And the commodity folks can't do that.
And, you know, to get back to the festival, this is a grander part of what we're doing, and what we're seeing is we have our, you know, U.S. Producers that are coming in. We have the smaller farm guys, cultivators that are coming in to join us. This is becoming a little bit more of a summit, not just for our customers to enjoy that aspect, but from, you know, serious people in the industry that are coming in, that are enjoying the festival, that are, you know, possibly doing a panel talk. They're talking about medicinals, mm-hmm. and we all have to kind of get together. This is like, community through fungi is kind of our backbone of this event. And it's fascinating, the conversations that come up, the different issues that we're seeing. I think the more that we share with each other, the more that we know, it really does make a difference. And so
Santa Cruz Mountains Mushroom Festival is mm-hmm. right over the hill from Silicon Valley in the San Francisco Bay Area Metroplex. And there are a lot of people who are mushroom devotees, almost crazy in their passion for mushrooms. At least that's my impression watching them. But they're totally into mushrooms, almost unlike any other food. Do you see that as well?
One of the most amazing things that I witnessed at the last festival, was the first day. We hadn't had rain in over a month, and it just really came down on Saturday, to the point where we were all looking at each other in the festival, as, you know, the organizers thinking, oh my God, this is going to ruin our day. This is not the way to start. And the look on all of everybody who still showed up, over 3,000 people showed up just with huge smiles on their faces and all in their raincoats and with their picking baskets. I was like, if this isn't going to stop people from showing up, then nothing really will. And it's just, they adapt so well, and they are just, there is such a need for a lot of people to just get more understanding out of it. And so it was just a great opportunity, and it still, you know, it at the end of it, after a couple hours of it downpouring, it kind of cleared out, and people thought it was phenomenal. And it was quite a scene to witness everybody still coming through the gates and enjoying the day. So, that was pretty cool. And it just, how much people are into it.
Yeah. Mushroom people in the rain. What could be better, right?
Yeah.
There you go. Hey. Now, take us in Garoni, out into the city, and help us find a way to connect with those mushroom people. How would we do that? How would we find others in the community in which we live that are devotees of the mushroom?
Every good-sized town generally has a mycological society. And those are amateur mycologists, wild foragers, small, business people that get together, and just the lovers of mushrooms get together once a month, have a newsletter talking about big events and big locations that mushrooms are going to start popping. For me, the mycological societies are probably one of the better ways to start that connection on the wild side of things and foraging. We have such a strong community of restaurants here that are, just absolutely, enamored with the wild and fresh mushrooms. It's really like to enjoy mushrooms and try something novel. It is really kind of like going out to, a restaurant that might have some local farms on the menu and kind of experience the, that are going for that local sustainable approach. And that's wonderful. And I also think that, farmers markets, we do 15 farmers markets. And, when I started off at 6 years old, I think there was only a couple around
right. In
the farmers markets. Even at doing 15 in the Bay Area, we only really do a fraction of the farmers markets, and all of them have.
Ian Garoni, Far West Fungi. Ian, thank you so much for joining me. What fun.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.